In that Gary and I did not really actively choose to be each other's colleagues. This was chosen for us by our intellectual parents at UCSB, Jim Hartle, Bob Sugar. So when I arrived, I was very happy to very quickly learn what a wonderful colleague Gary would be and has been for these last several decades. We've heard from several people that there are no stories about Gary, but we've also conclusively learned that this is not true. There are many stories about Gary. It's just that they're all good stories. And what I've learned over the decades is that what you want in a colleague is someone for whom all the stories are good. So thank you, Gary, for being that person, and happy birthday. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, George Santos, who will speak on GEONs, black holes, and all that jazz.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to speak here, namely to the organizers, but also to Gary. Thank you so much for letting me speak here. I don't know how difficult it was for you to talk about something that Gary has worked on. For me, it was difficult not to choose a paper written with Gary, to present here something that I've not written with Gary. Over the past 5 years, we published a total of 12 papers, and still more to come. So Gary has played a paramount role in my short career. So thank you so much for that. But I must say, I've been getting a little bit worried about my relationship with Gary. And the reason is the following. So we have these three pictures here, right? And then Gary is very happy. And guess what? We started working together there. I thought I was a joyful guy, but maybe I'm just miserable. That's my normal state anyway. Okay, so the work I'm going to present here, you'll see Gary's name will show up like 300 times. But the final piece of work was actually done in collaboration with Oscar Diaz, currently at Southampton, and with Benson Way. He was a PhD student of Gary. We are now very lucky to have him in DAMT, in Cambridge. And I must say that he really played an absolutely astronomical work in getting this work to actually be accomplished. Okay, so what am I going to talk today about? This is the menu. Start with some motivation. I'm going to tell you about two very distinct instabilities in ADS, one we've seen a little bit about. The other one is the so-called Santa Horowitz instability. I'm going to tell you what that is. Then I'll discuss some new solutions that I've constructed with Gary in 2014. The GEONs, we'll see that they arise naturally from studying one of these instabilities. And I'm going to tell you that these instabilities are actually connected in the moduli space of solutions. And this is one black hole to interpolate them all and in the darkness bind them. Then I'll end up with some outlook. Okay, so what is the motivation? So I'm first going to give you a spoiler alert of what we're going to find. We're going to construct novel black hole solutions in ADS4, okay? And they will only have one killing field. So they will seem to violate the rigidity theorem in ADS. And before Mukund asks me this, because last time I talked about this, he completely grilled me, this has been shown in ADS, okay? And these are the authors. The rigidity theorem has been proved in ADS. So this is what we're going to do. What is the correspondence? I almost feel ashamed of saying what is the motivation to study this. It's, of course, ADS-CFT correspondence, which maps asymptotically ADS solutions of the Einstein equation to states of a dual conformal field theory. Okay? And in particular, I'm interested in solutions that only have gravity. Okay? So they lie at the core in the most universal sector of the theory. There will be no other matter besides gravity, okay? Just to make this completely clear, this is the equation of motion that I'll use throughout all of my talk. That's it, nothing else, okay? Of course, the biggest motivation to study solutions in these equations is, of course, that Gary has done an extensive work on this subject in the past, and we're celebrating his birthday. No better thing to do. Okay, good. Here is the first instability that I'm going to discuss. It's called super-radius instability, okay? And I'm going to be very pedestrian, so I'm going to start very slowly, I hope. So rotating black holes can have regions which can act as a negative energy reservoir for charged particles. In fact, we've seen that Santa can use that in his favor and go around the world, right? So here is a black hole, here is an ergo region, it's rotating along this direction, and you can use the Penrose process, also called the Santa-Horowitz triality, to show that you can send a particle in, you can set the momentum, you can set a little bomb, I'm not so sure if I'm allowed to say this in the US, but you can set a little bomb to fire there, you align the momenta of your two resulting particles to be in such a way that one particle comes out, one particle goes in, but because you can have negative energy here, the particle that comes out must have higher energy than the particle that went in. So that's the Penrose process. There's a wave analog of this process. It's called the super-radiant scattering, in which you send a wave, it scatters, and the wave that comes out has a larger amplitude, okay? But if we're in ADS, you have a big problem. Because now I put this inside a box, the wave comes out, bounces off again, comes back in, steals more energy, comes back, bounces off again, and eventually, there's so much energy contained inside this wave that I can just neglect this process. It leads to an instability, okay? Incidentally, you can also put the Dirichlet wall in flat space. This is the so-called box black hole, and the same thing happens. So this leads to an instability, okay? So because we're celebrating Gary's birthday, I decided that I at least had to put some line elements on the board. I had to show some metrics. I usually don't like to do this, but let's do it here. So this is the Kerr-EDS-4 solution. So this is a Kerr black hole. I don't want you to think much about this. Incidentally, this is a funny solution, because we call it the Kerr-EDS black hole, which was actually discovered by Carter. So I don't know why we don't call it the Carter solution. But in any case, it depends on two parameters, M and A, okay? This parameterizes basically the mass of the black hole and the rotation of the black hole. That's it. Now, in order to discuss stability of this solution, it is very convenient to change to a new set of coordinates that parameterize the solution, which is not the energy and angular momentum. Instead, it's the aerial radius of the black hole. So it's a certain square root of the entropy, which is completely gauge invariant, and some angular velocity. Now, everybody knows that rotating black holes cannot rotate too fast, because if they rotate too fast, their basically temperature would be negative, and you would have naked singularities. So there is a bound on how fast you can rotate. So don't, you know, just take from this that there is a bound, nothing else. Okay. Perhaps what is most important is that this solution has two commuting Killing fields. There's a d by dt and d by d phi. And what you want to do now is to actually perturb this solution in time. We're going to take advantage of the fact that there's a d by dt and a d by d phi to expand our perturbations in terms of its Fourier components. Now, by doing this, I'm losing some type of initial data, but I'm not going to worry about this. I'm still going to do a Fourier mode decomposition. And the rule of the game is simple. You impose ingoing boundary conditions at the horizon, you impose normalizability at infinity, and you search for poles on the complex plane where the imaginary part of the frequency is positive. If you find that, then you have an unstable quasi-normal mode, and the system is unstable. It drives you exponentially away from the system where you started. Now, this seems like an easy exercise. This was only done in 2013. It's actually a little bit more subtle than what you might think, to actually perturb this black hole and look at its quasi-normal modes. Only 2014. So what does the space of solutions look like? So here I have this aerial radius. Here I have the angular velocity. And this is the extremal limit, OK? Around here, you have naked singularities, so we don't like to go there. So we stay always below this line, OK? So this is the phase diagram for Kerr-EDS black holes. Good. So Stephen and Harvey have shown that there is very good reasons to believe that at least a linear mode analysis would not give instabilities below omega L smaller than 1. Okay? They gave very convincing arguments for that. Furthermore, they also showed, or they also gave very convincing arguments, that the system should be unstable above this line. So only in 2014 we were actually able to check this with Vitor and Lewis and Gavin and Oscar. And indeed, we found that, for instance, if we take a perturbation with m equals to 2, that the system is unstable above this blue line here. So right here, all Kerr-EDS black holes are unstable to perturbations with m equals to 2. For now, I will take m equals to 2 case. I will tell you what happens when you have more general m's in a little bit. But let's focus on the m equals to 2 case. So around here, the system should be stable to those perturbations, but up here, it should be unstable, okay? Right at along this line, the instability shuts down. So the imaginary part of the frequency is exactly zero, okay? So it saturates this inequality at the onset of the instability. Now, it's really nice to discuss the stability of these black holes in these coordinates, just because the stability line is like a horizontal line. But in fact, if you want to study dynamical stability, it's always good to work in the microcanonical ensemble, okay? So I'm going to change this picture from this aerial radius and this angular velocity to a picture in terms of E and J, the energy and the angular momenta. But I'm going to keep the same color coding. This is what we get. So this is extremality now. You cannot rotate too fast. This is the onset of the instability. To the left of this dashed curve, the system is stable. And then there's this zone here in the middle that is stable to m equals to 2 perturbations. Okay? So what about m equals to 3 or 4 or 5? What happens in that case? Well, in that case, if you start increasing m, you start populating between these two lines. So let me tell you what this means. Take a point here. That guy is unstable to m equals to 2 and m equals to 3 perturbations. Okay? If you take a point there, that is stable to m equals to 2, but unstable to m equals to 3. Okay? And in fact, it was shown by my good friends Harry, James, and Harvey that if you take m equals to infinity, we exactly cover this curve. Okay? That's the onset of the full instability. Okay, are there any questions about this phase diagram right now? Because I'm going to completely change gears. So, good time. No? Okay. So it's great that Louis gave a talk before me, because I'm now going to tell you about the nonlinear stability of ADS. So it seems I've jumped completely topic. I'm talking about something completely different, okay? So what is the question that we'd like to address here? Well, consider some spacetime. It's a metric and some line element, together with some prescribed boundary conditions if a time-like boundary exists, ADS. Okay, that's a good example. So take this. Now, what you want to do is to take a certain Cauchy surface on this space-time, let's call it S, and perturb it ever so slightly, in a suitable sense. So in fact, when you prove stability, it's suitable sense that is a difficult part. But let's perturb so slightly this Cauchy hypersurface in your space-time. And now let's look at the future evolution of this Cauchy hypersurface that was perturbed. The question that we want to address is the following. Does the resulting space-time still have the same causal structure as the space-time we started with? Or does it change completely? Okay? So that's one of the questions. If you're a mathematician, you actually want to go a lot further than this. You want to bound the difference between the resulting space-time and the space-time that you started with in terms of your initial data, in terms of how much you've deformed your Cauchy hypersurface. In fact, if you're a mathematician, you even want to go further. You want to check exactly how you approach this. As a power law, as an exponential, which type of power law you get. It's actually a very complicated mathematical problem, okay? For the purposes of this talk, this is what I want to address. If you start with a space-time that is geodesically complete, does it remain geodesically complete in the future? Okay, let me take an example. Take ADS, perturb ADS, do you necessarily form black holes in the future or not? That's the question we want to address. So what is known about this problem? Okay. At the linear level, anti-de Sitter space, Minkowski space, and de Sitter space are almost alike. In de Sitter space and in Minkowski space, waves disperse and go off to infinity. They never come back. That's what happens at the linear level. In anti-de Sitter space, you still find no growing modes, but waves come disperse. So the waves go, but they're forced to return back, and so there's actually no dispersion. The waves will just keep bouncing back and forth. At the nonlinear level, with a 500-page monogram, Christodoulou and Kleinerman actually managed to prove that Minkowski space in 5 dimensions is actually stable. You perturb it ever so slightly with a finite but small perturbation, and that perturbation will remain small as you evolve it in the future. It will actually disperse. It turns out that to prove this in dimension bigger or equal than 5, it's a lot easier, just because gravity is weaker, and this has all to do with how fast the fields decay. It's also a lot easier to do it for the sitter, because the expansion of the universe helps you. It just takes things away from inside the patch that you're considering. But, you know, Where's the odd cousin? There's Minkowski, there's the sitter, where's anti-Sally? Why has this never been shown for anti-sitter space? Well, I like to quote Gary, because Gary once said this in a talk. It's just not true. Okay, we would love to have a result like that, but that doesn't seem to happen. So the claim is the following. If you take some generic, small but finite perturbations about ADS, eventually they become large and form black holes. That's it. Okay? So that's the claim. I'm going to back up the claim with numerical simulations done by extremely competent people. And furthermore, these black holes do not form in any arbitrary way. They form in a way that resembles very much the onset of turbulence in fluids. So you see a cascade towards smaller and smaller scales, but eventually in GR there's a natural cutoff. If the energy is going towards smaller and smaller scales, the Hoopp conjecture will tell you, well, you must form a black hole. And that's why you form a black hole in this case. And in fluids, for instance, you don't. So what is the heuristic for this instability? Well, when this result came out, again, most of us in holography just said, well, that's so obvious. Take a sphere, okay? Perturb, put your CFT there. Perturb it ever so slightly. What do you expect the system to do? Well, at finite energy, the system will thermalize. And at finite energy, the only available system should be a black hole, because that's the guy that has highest entropy. So the system is just thermalizing. Another way of saying this, any generic finite excitation which is added to this block is expected to explore all configuration spaces, including those with small black holes. So black holes should form. Okay? This was an heuristic argument. The nice thing about this heuristic argument is that you can run it backwards. You can just say, what if I really fine-tune my perturbation? Maybe I do not need to form black holes, because I'm fine-tuning my perturbations a lot. It's not generic. And indeed, at least at the perturbative level, we actually found some solutions which basically do not seem to thermalize, in the sense that they correspond to nonlinear realizations of perturbations of ADS. They have no black holes, and you can, we don't know if they exist for arbitrarily large amplitude, but you can construct it. The thing is, when we put out this paper together with Oscar, we only had these solutions at the perturbative level. We only went to fifth order in perturbation theory, and a lot of people were seriously doubting that our construction would work beyond the perturbative regime. We actually received several emails questioning that. Now, these solutions are very special. They're exactly periodic in time, okay? And they have a single continuous symmetry, which is like a helical killing field. So that's the only symmetry that they have nothing else. Furthermore, for those of you that are more GR inclined, you should think of these solutions as the analog of nonlinear gravitational waves, but in ADS, okay? Now, this heuristic argument is very good, very nice, but it's wrong, okay? It's wrong because of the following. Later on, in a paper with Don, and these are the three gentlemen here, we actually gave very good arguments to actually expect stability when you deform the boundary theory ever so slightly. So put it on a very small, slightly deformed ellipsoid instead of a sphere. In that case, black holes do not form, okay? That's very strange. On an S2, black holes form for arbitrarily small data. On an ellipsoid, it's still a compact space, so you would still say the same. Black holes do not seem to form. So these two heuristics is actually wrong. And we still don't understand exactly why it's wrong. So what has actually been observed numerically? So this is some work that appeared before our work, and then it's an amazing tour de force calculation. It studies the formation of black holes within spherical symmetry. So if you're looking at spherically symmetric configurations, you cannot study formation of black holes just with gravity because there's no gravitational waves. So you include a scalar field, and you include a massless scalar field. These people, Piotr and Andrei, they actually done this, and Luisa has shown this plot, and here's what they find. This is the amplitude of the wave that they're considering. This is the radius, or this is the location of the apparent horizon. They see that if the amplitude is large enough, you form a black hole. Then you decrease the amplitude, and you reach a point where you form a zero-sized black hole. Now, this is certainly not a violation of cosmic censorship, because I'm fine-tuning that number to be a very, very specific number. And around that vicinity, you should see something like Schottky's critical scaling, because, you know, if the black hole is really, really small, you're just like in flat space. That's exactly what you find. Now, if you were in flat space, that was it. But you're in ADS, and ADS acts like a covariant box. So if you consider an amplitude that is smaller than that number, The wave will go through the origin, come back, bounce on the AVS fault, and on the second trial, it will form a black hole. You keep going, and then it's on the third trial that will form a black hole. And the claim is, no matter how small you have your energy, eventually you form a black hole. How fast do you form a black hole? That's a question you might ask. Depends on the amplitude. And in our paper, we gave a very, in my opinion, convincing argument that if you use naive KAM intuition, the breakdown of your quantum perturbation theory appears at third order. And so you can ask, when does the perturbation theory breakdown occur? Well, it occurs when the third order perturbation becomes of the same order as the first order perturbation input in. And with that, you conclude that black holes or some nonlinear instability should occur with this time scale. It should go as 1 over epsilon to the minus 2. And if you actually do a fit here, it works like a charm. Okay, that's exactly the time scale that you get. Good.
Is that specifically for four dimensions?
No. No, it's always a third order in perturbation theory.
Do I mean the time scale?
Because it's always a third order in perturbation theory, it's always like that. Thank you. Well, the issue is that certain types of initial data apparently do not do this. Okay? I actually think that they can be interpreted in a certain way as some still very special solutions, but the claim is that certain, even for the case of R cross S2, certain types of solutions do not seem to thermalize. Okay? So even here, it seems that you have trouble. Only some of them seems to thermalize. But I actually want to try to understand these more special solutions. Okay? I want to try to understand the solutions that do not thermalize at all by construction. I will define them as solutions that exist at the nonlinear level of the Einstein equations that are completely smoothless and have a certain energy. This is what me and Gary decided to do in 2014. It was an absolutely Herculean calculation. So we want to search for regular solutions of the Einstein equations, which we coin geons, that do not seem to thermalize. Okay, that's what we want to do. We went to solve the equations. There's 10 nonlinear equations that you have to solve. And this is what you find, for instance, for the stress energy tensor. Okay, so you have regions of negative and positive energy around the equator, and all of this structure is rotating with constant angular velocity. Okay? So this means that, in fact, this solution is invariant under a single Killing field, d by dt plus omega over m d by d phi. This guy, and this is very important, we'll need this later, thanks to Ball, we'll need this later. This Killing field is time-like near the poles, but it's space-like near the equator. And it's the only Killing field you have in your solution. Okay? We can actually prove this. Now, I remember constructing this solution, and again, Gary is an absolute genius, because 5 minutes later, he came to me and said, hey, they should satisfy the first law. And I'm like, the first law? But then there's no horizon. What do you mean, man? But in fact, indeed, they do satisfy the first law. There's no horizon term here, but there's still an m d by d equal omega d by dj. And this was awesome because we could test our numerics, because they have to satisfy this first law. Now, it is completely unclear if they can have the same energy as very large AVS black holes. For that, I would need to push the numerics that we have right now, and it's extremely hard. Okay? So it's an open problem. Okay, good. So now we have these solutions that only have one single Killing field. And because I am in Santa Barbara, this is the right campus to ask the following. Can I surf a geon or not? Okay? How do you surf? In theory. In theory. In practice, don't ask me. So in theory, you have a wave. It has a certain phase velocity. What you're going to do is to align your phase velocity with that of the wave. And with a bit of luck, you'll manage to surf. Okay? That's exactly what we're going to try to do here. Let's try to see if we can construct a black hole that can actually surf the geon. Let's try to put a little black hole at the center and see if it can co-rotate with this cloud of gravitons. So imagine that the cloud of gravitons is not rotating. It was static. If you put the little black hole in the middle, what are you expecting the black hole to do? To lit the cloud of gravitons, right? Just forward. So in principle, you shouldn't be able to find them. However, if the cloud of gravitons is rotating, and if the black hole is also rotating, you can expect the centrifugal force to balance the gravitational attraction, and thus be able to put their black hole in the middle. That's exactly what happens here. You align the angular velocity of your black hole with that of the gym, and then you surf the gym. This is precisely the condition that you need to ensure that there's no flux across the horizon. And so the black hole is not eating the cloud of gravitons that sits outside. Okay? So that's the idea. So if such solutions exist, they only have one killing field. We named that black resonator. And they were actually conjectured by Harvey to exist in 2003 in a paper that was changed 6 times in archive. You have to tell me why you did that, man. In any case, they were conjectured. They were conjectured to exist in 2003, and they were conjectured to be actually the endpoint of the superluminescent instability. Okay, so things are falling into place. These guys were conjectured to be the endpoint of the superluminescent instability. We had a GN on the other hand. This is how we obtained them, because we made this black hole surf the GN, and now we want to test this. Are really the endpoint of the instability, these guys? Okay. But now you might think, wait a minute, there's a rigidity theorem. What did you do? You know, Stephen will not be happy. After all, I mean, you're working in his institution, he will fire you if this is not correct. So it evades the rigidity theorem because the only killing field you have is your Eisen generator. And if you look at the rigidity theorem, it tells you the following. Start with a killing field that is not your Eisen generator. Then, if you have a well-defined killing horizon, another killing field should exist. But here, the only killing field you have is actually the horizon generator. And that's how you can evade Hawking's rigidity theorem. Or I should say, Holland's rigidity theorem. So we've actually constructed these beasts. There are 10 coupled three-dimensional linear partial differential equations. And thanks to Toby, I can say they're of the elliptic type. So that's fantastic. You're in a conference and you can make your results stronger by listening to other speakers. So that's great. And here is how they look. Okay? Do not get scared. I will present the line element for these solutions, okay? It will be big. Here they are. This is their lineup. I don't want you to take much out of this, except that there's 10 functions that we have to solve for, okay? Also, that this line element depends on 2 parameters. Depends on one in a very explicit way, it's just a temperature, which is parameterized by this y plus, and it depends on another parameter, which we call the wiggliness parameter, which tells you how wiggly is your horizon. Okay, and it's defined at these integrals, so it's defined in a non-local way. Ask me later why we decided to do this. Okay, and because I'm talking here and in the audience there's Don, let me tell you that this has a well-defined killing horizon. Okay, so there's no business about flowing geometries here. It's all good. In fact, you can trace the fact that, you know, that you have a well-defined killing horizon to the fact that these solutions are that solutions. That you have elliptic equations. Okay, that's what lies at the core of this. What do we find? This is what we find. Okay, so here I've put the geons. Okay, this is the onset of the m equals to 2 instability, the superluminescent instability. Okay, and I either increase r plus, for instance, or decrease r plus, and I go in this direction, for instance. Or I keep y plus fixed and I increase epsilon and go in these directions. Okay? If the wiggliness parameter is very, very small, well, I shouldn't have any wiggle, so I should go back to curry the S. That's exactly what we see. If the wiggliness parameter is very, very small, I go back to the onset of the superluminescent instability. So this is looking good for Harvey, because it seems that these guys are connected to the onset of the superluminescent instability. So thumbs up. Okay? On the other hand, if I decrease the size of the black hole by decreasing y plus, it seems that I'm going towards the geon, which is exactly how we motivated the construction of these solutions. Okay? So these new type of black holes seem to basically interpolate between these two instabilities. Now, what is striking about this? Well, the first point is that these black resonators exist in regions where the Curry-DS solution is beyond externality. There we are. For those of you that like supersymmetry, if you actually look at the m equals infinity limit of these solutions, they actually saturate the BPS bound, which is somewhere here along this line. Okay, so geons with m equals infinity would saturate the BPS bound. But something that you might be now wondering is, well, you constructed these solutions. Have you looked at their entropy? Okay, let's check if they're actually thermodynamically favored with respect to the Curry-DS solutions. Now, there is a nuance here. Our black holes depend on time. So talking about thermodynamics here looks a little bit fishy in entropy, because we have a time-dependent solution. But let's proceed because we have a well-defined killing horizon, so I'm still going to define this thing. And what we see is that whenever black resonators coexist with the curry gas solutions, they have a higher entropy. So things are looking really good for Harvey. Because, you know, if you look at something here at finite energy, this is the curry gas solution, and the solution we just constructed has a higher entropy. Furthermore, it looks like a second order phase transition. It really looks like almost done, right? It looks that this will be the endpoint of the instability. This is an horizon, this is an embedding of the horizon, which turns out to obey to the exact same equation that Yao was telling about. It's a minimal embedding curve here. And you can see that you should imagine that this is rotating along this axis. Okay? So indeed, there is a deformation along the horizon, and the black hole is just rotating along this deformation. So you might be wondering, wait a minute, if it's rotating, why aren't you radiating? I am radiating, all right. But because the radiation bounces off the ADS walls, it is absorbed exactly at the right rate so that I can rotate and co-rotate with the solution. Good. Fantastic. So is this really the endpoint of the instability? Have we done it? That's the question. Well, if the dynamics was restricted to m equals to 2 and m equals to 2 only, yeah, that's good. In fact, you can prove that this is what happens in holographic superconductors that U2 with Chris did. It's exactly when you isolate m equals to 2. It's having a specific charge for the holographic superconductors. And in holographic superconductors, you can do that. But here, they're all coupled. Okay? So you cannot do. So remember that the m equals to 2 perturbations became stable in a region where the curry gas solution was still unstable to m equals to 3, and m equals to 4, and m equals to 5, and so on. Okay? That's just a fact. There's another fact I have to tell you, is that the central black hole is always very well approximated by a curry gas black hole. The cloud doesn't like to disturb too much the black hole. So the central black hole is very well approximated. Now, before I came to this conference, I was going to put here, this is very likely to be unstable. But thanks to the talk by Bo, I can actually prove to you that this solution turns out to actually be unstable. Because this case space-like in certain regions close to the boundary, so there's no way in hell that these guys are stable. They will be unstable. They will be unstable to higher M modes. There's another argument. You can actually construct these black resonators for different values of M, and they turn out to have higher entropy. So if the standard theory is correct, and I'm following the maximum entropy state, I should evolve towards higher and higher and higher M. Okay? So it's likely that the conjecture that we put forward in 2011 is correct. There is no endpoint. Why? Because the energy is flowing and flowing and flowing towards smaller and smaller scales. But this means, in a nutshell, that we're very likely to need deep brains. And so Eva gets all happy. Why is that the case? We're putting energy in smaller and smaller and smaller scales. It's very natural that somewhere further down the line, I'll have curvatures that are at least at the Planck order. So I need something to save me here. And that something could well be string theory. So I'm not saying that this violates the weak cosmic censorship, because I'm not saying that this happens in a finite amount of time. It could take an infinite time for this to occur. But certainly the spirit of the cosmic censorship is at jeopardy. Because eventually, even if I have to, you know, I do not reach infinity, but I'll reach a very large number where I'll need quantum mechanics to save me. So this is an example where you have an instability that has no stationary endpoint within classical general relativity. Conclusions. We have constructed black holes with a single killing field. They interpolate between superradiance and the onset. Superradiance onset and GM, sorry. And they seem to dominate the microcanonical ensemble because they have higher entropy. Now, what can you ask me after my talk? Is there infinite non-uniqueness for curry DS? How large is it? What is the story in the canonical and grand canonical ensemble? Remember, this is all good, but these black holes are very tiny. If they are very tiny, this means that at least in the canonical ensemble, the phase that dominates is just a bunch of gravitons in ADS. It's not this phase. But I'm insisting to work in the microcanonical ensemble, in which case these guys should be the relevant phase. But there's also a story here. Now, what I would love to do, what is the field theory interpretation of this phenomenon? You guys are much smarter than I am, so you should elucidate me about this. Can we make a connection with classical physics? So why do I ask this? I'm asking this because it seems that we have many, 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 many matrix stable states. The system is just evolving very slowly through many, many metastable states. In fact, there's an infinite number of these metastable states, and this really smells a little bit like classic physics, because the system doesn't know where to go, at least for a big one. You can make an effective potential out of these systems you constructed indeed. And so I'd like to end, and again, wish very good birthday to Gary. Thank you.
So it's certainly a natural conjecture that, as you said, the instability goes on, you excite higher and higher M modes. Whether or not that actually leads to an unbounded curvature would seem to depend on how much power goes into those high M modes.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, if you look numerically at your M equals 2, 3, 4, et cetera, solutions for fixed energy, to see if the curvature is you know, the Kretschmann scalar is growing with M.
That is certainly true. It is growing with M.
And I mean, if you plotted it, does it look like it's going to converge to a finite value, or does it look like it's going to...
I plotted for M equals to 2, 4, and 6, and it was like that.
Okay.
If that number turns out to be an uncomputable number, yeah, then I don't know. In the whole thing sense, yeah. It looks like you're in a mass. You have to go there and then...
So this is kind of related to Don's question, but one of your arguments for the endpoint not existing was the fact that the entropy goes up. Uh-huh. Does it go up in the same way that the power in the higher M modes goes up?
I don't know. That's a very good question.
So, you know, in particular, could it be possible that the entropy would, you know...
Saturate?
Yeah, saturate
no,
some.
No, it doesn't. So there's another beautiful story I can tell you here. These black holes are really tiny, right? So you might think, well, if they're really tiny, why don't you just use a matched asymptotic expansion to predict what is the entropy and all of these things as a function of M? It turns out you can do that. And in fact, it matches very well our results. And with that, I can get an expression for the entropy as a function of M at fixed energy for arbitrary values of M. And they match very well what we see, and we see that they grow unboundedly. So they do not saturate.
Sorry, you say fixed energy?
Fixed energy.
If you turn up M, the entropy diverges.
That's right.
Oh.
And he's absolutely right. You can do this with a matched asymptotic expansion. In fact, you need very little. These guys are interacting so slowly that you just need to compose a mixture of these two and assume that they don't interact very, very, it's exactly like what they do. Again, Gary knows all of this story, so I'm not even sure if his name shouldn't be there in the list of collaborators. Yeah, so you can do this without doing much possible.
Can you change the value in a way that which is uniform at M?
That is a good question. Well, I mean, it's fixed energy, so I would assume yes.
It's a question.
Yeah, it's a question. Yes, Veronica.
You also recently thought about products of ADS and spheres in context of black holes. So do you have any sort of thoughts about what happens if you reinstate the sphere?
For a while I got really excited because I thought that was exactly how ADS would know that could not go here. It turns out it doesn't help us. The instability is always to the wrong side. I've computed the onset of that instability that you and Mukund found as a function of the angular momentum. Doesn't help you. It's on the wrong side. That instability flashes towards the wrong side. But it's a very good question. For a while, we were mega excited, or at least I was. I don't think my collaborators were, but I'm excited with anything anyway.
I just want to state the obvious. That it's really true that the entropy diverges. I just wanted to state the obvious for the record, which is that if it's really true that the entropy diverges as M goes to infinity at fixed energy, you are predicting that the dual CFT has an infinite entropy at some fixed energy, which is some massive new phase transition in the dual theory that we do not understand, which seems extremely surprising.
Yep. If there's this problem with trying to sort of, see how convergent is the series with M. So there's this issue which I've not checked.
In fact, doesn't this contradict what we think we understand about just the thermal ensemble at high temperature bounding
good.
The
this is
density
not,
of
this
states?
This is in the microcanonical
doesn't
ensemble.
Matter.
No.
I mean, we think, we certainly have various evidence we could review that at high energy, it's the Schwarzschild black hole which captures the entropy.
This is all at
if you don't
small
fix
energies. This is all at small energies.
fine, if there's infinite entropy at low energies, there's also infinite entropy at high energies.
Why? This instability shuts down if the black hole is very large. You have to be mega close to externality in order to see.
We'll talk about it later.